My guest today is Professor Rupert Sheldrake. Dr. Sheldrake is a former research fellow of the Royal Society. He studied natural sciences at Cambridge University, where he was a scholar at Clare College and took a double honors degree and was awarded the University Botany Prize. He has studied philosophy at Harvard University, where he was a Frank Knox Fellow, and before returning to Cambridge, where he took up a PhD in biochemistry. He is a fellow of Clare College, Cambridge University. Nice to have you with us today.
Pleasure.
I always begin my programs with a long story of an introduction, but it's germane to our topic. The year was in the mid-1980s. I had been doing a lecture every week for 2 years with my brother to a group of about 250 people, the max that could fit into a lecture hall. It was free. And the lecture was supposed to be for about an hour and a half. We never got out of there under 5 hours, because after the lecture, there would be one more question, never ended. And one day, my brother said, just before we were walking to the lecture, "I'm not doing it anymore." I said, "Why not?" He says, "We're not helping anybody." I said, "Of course we're helping people." He said, "No, we're not. You think we're helping people. That's your illusion. The reality is, we're not." And I thought he was just having a bad day, and I said, "Fine." So when we went down there, he said, normally we would do a lecture. He'd say, "We're going to do something a little different today. Let's go around the room and see how you've been able to actualize what you've learned over the last 2.5 years. And he went down each row, and as each person was asked, they would say something similar. "Oh, I've learned a lot. You know, I've learned so much about vitamins and health. But how have you actualized it?" And they hadn't, the entire room. And at the end of that, they left after an hour and a half, 2 hours. And I thought, wow, now I hadn't caught that. My brother had, but he said, "There's another lesson to learn." So we waited a half hour. I didn't know why, but he just was in silence and we sat there. And then he said, "Okay." So we got up and instead of going back up towards where we lived, he walked right across the street, and on the corner, the place was mobbed, was a Burger King. And all the people were in the class were in there, eating the hamburgers and the hot dog, just, you know, whatever they had, they were gobbling it up. And that really depressed me. Here I thought that giving good information for free, so nobody would be deprived, that somehow it would morph into, it would be the progenitor to real authentic change. So I took a trip immediately. I just wanted to get out of New York. I wanted to get away from all this to try to reflect. And I flew out to Arizona, and I drove out into the desert. And then I just stopped. I went out, and I just sat and meditated. And early in the morning, as the sun was rising, an epiphany happened. I just remember in a flash, everything was just pure white. And then suddenly I had a knowing. I suddenly understood why, at the heart of the movements that we have all appreciated, like the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, or women's rights movement, the animal rights, human rights, environmental rights, only about 1% of the population ever participated in any major movement. I understood that. And it came down to this. I understood, suddenly the issues of my life were understood, where before they were points of frustration. It was about our life energy. And I then understood why all my friends who were psychiatrists and psychologists and behavioralists had half the answer, but they were missing half. Because think of all the people who've gotten therapy, but they haven't really changed. If they were kind of psychotic and they went 10 years to therapy, they were now an educated psychotic, but they were still having these demons. And it was because I believe that we are born with a unique energy. And thus far, I've classified 7 such energies. The dynamic energies, like the people that run America, the people that are going to build the skyscrapers and do things like build a shuttle, the people who will cause things to happen. They have the big picture. Then there are those people who challenge those people, the people I call the dynamic assertives versus dynamic aggressives. The aggressives have to control everyone and everything in their life. The assertives like Martin Luther King or Gandhi or Spinoza or Maimonides, Socrates, Plato, these are the people who are equal in their capacity to see the big picture, but their goal in life is to maintain balance and be a voice for the voiceless. Then there's the dynamic supportives, those who are the givers, but are charismatic. You love to be around them because they're as comfortable as a well-worn shoe. They fit. I don't care where you're coming from, you always feel at home around them. The other two, you don't. You frequently feel intimidation. But these people are teachers. They're coaches. They help you facilitate change in your life. They answer questions. Then you have the worker bees. That's the largest single percentage of all people. I call them the adaptive supportives. They'll adapt to any environment, and they support it. They support the common good. Without them, who's going to make the clothes you're wearing? Who's going to manufacture, who's going to work at the post office 40 years? Or who's going to milk your cow to get your milk every day or grow your vegetables? These people don't seek fame and fortune. They're not confrontational. They're not going to go out voluntarily and start a demonstration, but they will support one if the leaders ask them to. Then you have the adaptive assertives, the geeks, the people that love to solve problems. I don't care what problem. They get excited about the idea that, gee whiz, I can do something. Hmm. And then you have the creative assertives. Now, if you're at a party at Cambridge and you have 20 of the world's greatest minds at a table, all informal, and suddenly someone walks in a gorilla outfit and sits at the end of the table and you all stare, who in the hell is that? And if someone says, oh, they're an artist. Oh, okay, they're an artist. And suddenly it's okay, you know, whatever they do, because they're an artist. But what does that mean? We've all seen it. We've experienced it. It means a unique life energy that feels and senses all things differently. And they're the ones who give color to life and to meanings. And they're the first to always challenge the abuses of authority, the cartoons, the caricatures, etc., the songs. And then you have one other group, and that is the adaptive aggressives. Oliver North is an adaptive aggressive. They're the ones who can facilitate, multitask, understand issues, are charming but not charismatic, but always are around dynamic people. They're the ones you got to be careful of, because on the downside, they're going to use everyone. They're manipulators. They're divisive. But on the upside, they can get a lot of stuff done that no one else. They're very big into details. Now, taken together, these all work like a symphony. And I call it a concept of harmonics, where they're in harmony. And depending upon which energy is matched with the other one, there will either be a real nice harmony and synchronicity, or there will not be. And that's why we're frequently confused about people who try to work together and it doesn't work. And then we try to blame one or the other instead of saying maybe the energy wasn't right. But with that simple dynamic, I've been able to explain so many things in life about myself and other people, and why some people will run for president and get elected, why Dennis Kucinich will never be president. Yet he's got the right issues on his side, but he's not a dynamic energy. He doesn't have the charisma. Bill Clinton could make mud pies and get elected emperor. All right? It's his energy. Fred Astaire had the energy. All right? We're caught up in people's energy, and we don't even know it. And yet, why do people cry at the, you know, used to cry and scream and go crazy at the Beatles concerts? And why are other people very subdued? And why do we watch people on television? It's the energy. So I wanted to share that with you for the following reason. I know that you've done an enormous amount of work with energy. And I believe that this energy is not only understandable, but it's transferable. And that there are people who understand how to master their energies, both to communicate and to heal. And I believe that this also is the same in the animal kingdom. I've identified it in animals as well, as I have a large group of animals, from primates and capuchins and lemurs, and I've seen it happen there as well. And one last thing. When my mother sent me a letter, the only letter she ever sent me in her life, she sent all of us sons the letter. I held the letter and knew that it was my mother saying goodbye and that she would be dead before I could speak with her. I knew it. My other two brothers didn't know anything. Nothing in the letter was about dying. But the letter said how proud she was of her sons, and that she was tired, but she had done as much as she could to share what she knew about life with us. When I got the letter, I read it on a train going to Philadelphia. When I got there, I called, and she had died of a heart attack. That's that energy. Being able to connect with it at a primal level where the energies communicate before the voices do. Your thoughts, please.
Well, this is a very comprehensive big view of human nature. And I think the main difference in the way I think from the way you've expressed it is that where you use the word energy, I use the words field, the word field. And these are not opposites. According to modern physics, everything, all matter, is made of energy bound in fields. Energy is what makes things happen. Fields are what shape it and give it its particular form. So energy, the whole energy of the universe, can move from one form to another. You know, heat, light, electricity, muscular power, kinetic energy, etc., etc. But the forms it takes are shaped by fields. And my own work is largely about these organizing fields of human nature, of animal nature, and so forth. And the particular feature of the fields that I think is important is they have a kind of memory, a kind of habit to them. So what you call these different patterns of dynamic energy and organizing energy, I would simply translate into the word field. But I mean, otherwise, I mean, I hadn't thought of this particular classification. It makes a lot of sense to me as you explain it, but I would have to translate it into this field terminology.
Okay. Now let me pull it back for a moment. I later understood why those people, good people, would come to seek information and insight and help, but would not then self-actualize it to the level that another energy would, because I was able to define then their energies. And to test this, to see if I was wrong, I asked a group of psychiatrists, psychologists, friends of mine to observe a study, but not to interfere in it. I interviewed 20 people, brief interviews, to have a retreat at my summer, my home in New Jersey. Of those, all but three came on the same bus in the afternoon. When they got to my home, I wasn't there. I was there, but they didn't see me. I was next door. But the psychiatrists were, and they were letting people think they were just regular people coming for a weekend retreat. But I had put all junk food in the house, no healthy food. I had put a sign, don't use any of the toilets, and I had put garbage pails of garbage in the middle of the house all over. There'd been like nine giant piles of garbage 3 feet high that had gotten off the street that morning out of neighbors' garbage cans. And so all day, 5 hours they were there, and they whined and complained. They were going to the bathroom in my backyard. They were negative. At 6 o'clock, three other people came. And immediately upon entering the house, what's all this garbage? We don't know. It was here when we got here. We didn't do this. What's all Tootsie Rolls and Twinkies? This is a health retreat. Well, this is all that was here, so we had to eat it. No, no, no. Go to the health food store. You go down there and you get the carrots and you get the blah, blah. And you go clean all this up within 15 minutes. Why aren't the toilets being? Well, there's a sign. Well, there's nothing wrong with the toilet. Within 15 minutes, three individuals that no one knew, who didn't know each other, separate from each other, had completely organized everything. They had health food coming in. They were juicing. They cleaned up the place. They were starting to do meditation to calm everyone down. Yet no one knew each other. They were dynamic energies. And I had selected them based upon the feel of facing them and say, that's a dynamic energy. They organize. Dynamics organize every environment they're in. In humans or animals. Your thoughts, please.
I'm a biologist, so I think in terms of animals as much as I do in terms of people. These differences in animal societies, of course, we have them. We have leaders in different, they're organized differently. In some societies, you have alpha males. In other societies, you have leading females. In others, you have a more hierarchical structure like termite colonies and so forth. I would have thought these leadership qualities would come out in some kinds of society more than others. And I hesitate to say this, but I suspect that this, the kinds of thing you're observing may be more exaggerated in America than in other parts of the world, and more exaggerated in humans than in animals. In some parts of the world where you have traditional, you know, tribal societies and so on, you certainly have leaders, you certainly have chiefs and that kind of thing, but less self-elected and more sort of traditionally appointed. So the question that arises in my mind is it that some people are born that way? Is it that some of them are sort of trained that way or get to be that way through experience, family influence, and so forth? And you've studied it more than me, so can I ask you what you think about that? Can anyone become one of these dynamic characters, or do you have to start off as one?
I believe that you have to be born that way, and that no amount of repression or interference will ultimately keep you from manifesting. If the trouble is there's an up and down side to all energies, there's a balance and imbalance in all energy fields. And if you happen to be a person that is trying to live based upon your conditioning or those of your parents, a life that is not naturally what you are, you will succeed at it, but you will not feel happy. I will ask you, why do we look at so many successful people who are so empty and disguising their unhappiness and with constant distraction? If you took 1,000 billionaires, which there are, probably 95% are not happy people. So more money, more success, more power is not what they need.
No, I think that's clear. And studies in positive psychology, which I think is a very good movement in recent years, have looked at what makes people happy. What makes people happy on the whole is feeling part of the flow of what's going on rather than detached from it. And being absorbed in what's going on. It can be being engaged in some work you really find engaging, or dancing or singing, something that absorbs you. And I suppose one of the things about being a billionaire is you have to be obsessed with making money. I mean, they don't get rich just by accident, which means that particular obsession has to dominate the rest of life. It's a one-sided thing. What's your explanation for it? I mean, again, you've studied it more than me.
I don't think that people are trying to make more money just for its sake. I believe that almost everything we do in every field has a second message, and that is maintaining attention to a person. For example, someone who's going to build the largest ship in the world, the Oracle president, right? It's 500 feet long. At 500 feet, why don't you just hire an ocean liner, because you have an ocean liner, right? It's going to have 200 people. It's going to cost $1 million to travel 2 miles. What's the point of it? The point is not that that you have the biggest ship. The point is people are going to know you have the biggest ship. And so much of what we do today is we exaggerate normal behavior, because what do most people really need in order to be happy? They need a sense of belonging, a sense of balance in the environment they're in, a sense of joy, of the simple things of life, because most of our time in life is taken by simple things, not extraordinary moments. And yet most people seem to be overlooking that and going for something externalizing. We externalize our life. What do we achieve? What do we own? What's our titles? Degrees? I mean, you've been in academia. Get around enough academics and you begin to wonder, do they have anything other than their own story to tell? Most don't have the ability just to ask someone else about their point of view. They want to constantly reinforce their own. That's my own point of view, right or wrong on it. Something that's very close to, I think, very close to your heart, and see if you've had any experience like this. This past year, I have a little fennec fox, two of them, and a rescue center brought them to me because they were grossly malnourished 9 years ago. Their lifespan's only about 7 years. They can sometimes live to nine. And I brought them back to health, gave them all the right nutrients and love. But it's unique how they spent their time. The female almost always would spend her time away from the male, unless it was mating season, and in the same enclosure. But then one day I watched, and the female all day long and all night long was laying with her head across the neck of the male for 3 days. And then I went in and I examined the male on the morning of the third day, and that's when he just died. She knew he was dying. She sensed it. And he died of natural causes. And I thought how unique that was, that she knew the time that his time was up, and her affection for him was that she was going to bond with him every second until he passed.
That's a very interesting observation, and I think that this is something quite a lot of animals do. I did an extensive study of animals, particularly pets, and their relations to their owners. I wrote a book called Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Unexplained Powers of Animals. And in that book, in the research for it, I built up a database of more than 5,000 case histories from pet owners, dog trainers, police dog handlers, blind people with guide dogs, and so on. And the stories that people told fell into a number of categories. So I built up a kind of natural history. And in the book, I have a chapter based on part of that called Animals That Comfort and Heal. Very large number of people who keep dogs, cats, and other animals have found that when they're sick, the animals seem to know it. They're very, very good at picking it up in many cases. And it's particularly striking with cats, because some cats are extremely independent. They go out all day. They don't care much about their owners as long as they're fed. But sometimes these cats will come and start lying on somebody, especially if they're sick or if they're depressed or miserable. The cat will be with them, stay with them, sit on them, purr, make them feel warm, comforted. And then when they're better, it'll be off again. And this ability to comfort, to heal, to care for, to bond with, I think is probably very deep in animal nature, and of course in human nature too. We inherit it from animals. When a kid's fallen down and they're crying, you know, the natural instinct of a parent is to hug them, to hold them, and they feel better. And I think that this kind of behavior is very common in animals. So I think what your foxes were doing is perhaps what animals in the wild would do with each other when they're forming bonds, when they're needed, but it's something that a lot of our domestic pets do with us when they form bonds with us. And actually, I think that's one reason why so many people keep pets. In the United States, 50% of households have pets. Most people don't keep animals because they need to. In past centuries, people had to have dogs for guarding the house. They had cats to kill mice in the farmyard and so forth. Most people are not keeping animals because they need them anymore, at least for these utilitarian functions. They keep them because they need that bond with animals, something that reminds us of our own animal nature, and that are those instinctive animal properties that in the modern industrial world we may otherwise lose. And there are also studies that show that people who keep dogs and cats tend to live longer and have healthier lives. People who've had heart attacks tend to survive more if they keep a dog or a cat. And if it was just dogs, you might say, well, they get more exercise because they take the dog out for a walk. But it works even with cats, and cats provide no exercise for most people. But it's that sense of warmth and bonding and just animal presence which can have a healing effect.
Is it possible to have something else? A friend of mine was a chief nurse in a hospice. And starting about 10 years ago, they brought a particular cat in. And what was unique about this cat, of all the people in the hospice, the cat would only go to the person who was closest to death and would stay right with the person, wouldn't leave their side, sometimes 2 or 3 days till the person passed. And so the nurse began to see that, gee whiz, this is more than a coincidence, because every single person the cat goes to ends up dying. The cat had to have some form of energy that it was picking up, some force field that it was able to read intuitively, instinctually. And have you heard anything like that?
Yes, I have. In collecting the material for my book, I interviewed a number of people who have animals that serve in pet as therapy programs. Quite a number of hospitals and hospices have people bring in dogs or cats because they found that they help people who are sick, suffering, or dying. And there were several cases exactly like that on my database where dogs, in most cases I have dogs that do this, in a hospice would go and be with the person who was sickest, who was about to die, and stay with them. And these dogs somehow could pick this up. I mean, they have senses that we don't have, that, or at least if we do, we've lost a lot of these abilities that animals still have. Yes, so I think that's relatively common. It's also the case that some animals can pick up when people are going to have medical emergencies. And you've probably heard of these seizure alert dogs, which I did a special study of those, where many people who suffer from epileptic seizures, which can't be controlled by medication, lead a very restricted life because they can't go out because they're afraid they'd have a seizure unpredictably and they don't know when they're coming on. But many people who have this condition, if they keep dogs, find that the dogs can alert them to the seizure up to half an hour in advance. The dog will push them to a chair or a bed, make sure they sit down or lie down, sit there with their paws on them, keeping them in position, and stay by them until the seizure happens, and be with them while it's happening. This changes the lives of people who have epileptic seizures, and now it's a recognized form of service dog, the seizure alert dog, that some organizations like the Delta Society are actually training dogs as seizure alert dogs.
If you just joined us, I'm Gary Nall. My guest is Professor Rupert Sheldrake, and we're talking about energy in different forms or force fields. Let's go to what this might be, because you've given us some very unique and interesting examples. I had never heard that before about the dog, and I'm thankful I now know that because it ties in with other things we know. Explain to us where all this comes from, at least what your research has shown you or what you believe.
Well, I think that members of social groups form bonds with each other, that the nature of a social group is to form bonds. That's why it's a social group, not a random collection of individuals. In animal societies, these bonds coordinate the members of the group. So a flock of birds, for example, when it's flying, can change direction very rapidly. And at first people thought, well, they just look at their nearest neighbor or they follow a leader. But closer studies have shown that doesn't work. With a lot of birds, they're not following leaders. Ducks and geese do. They fly in these Vs with a leader at the end of the V. But other birds, like starlings, fly in large flocks, and the whole flock can change direction very, very rapidly. What it turns out to be is a kind of flock as a whole, the field of the flock as a whole, seems to influence the individuals within it. So the same is true of schools of fish. It's as if they're all responding to a field. And I think all social groups, termites, ants, wolves, and people, have these fields. Now, in some of them, there's a strong differentiation of roles, like in a social insect colony. There's workers, there's queens, there's workers doing different jobs. Some build the nest, others go out foraging for food, others defend the nest, and so on. There are other groups where there's no particularly strong differentiation. Schools of fish, there's no particular leader. The whole lot can change direction, and the ones that were at the side can become the leaders, and the ones at the back can become the leaders too. There's no particular differentiation there. Animals differ in the way these social groups are organized. But all of them, I think, have fields of organization that link together the members. One of my own particular lines of research is studying how these bonds between members of a group continue to exist even when the group separates. In wolf packs, the young stay behind in the den while the older wolves go out hunting. Even though they can be up to 100 miles away, it doesn't mean they've just forgotten about the young. In fact, they're hunting so they can bring food home for them. And I think that when they're at a distance, these fields that connect them continue to connect them, and I think that's the basis of telepathic communication, which I think is a normal form of communication in animal groups. People have it too, to a lesser degree than most animals. So I think that the bonds between members of a group, what coordinates their behavior, of course depend on the ordinary senses, but I think there's another element to this as well, another way in which influences pass between members of a group, which is invisible and which can have quite large effects.
It's very interesting. I'll share another thing on animals and see if this makes sense to you. I have capuchins, which are very bright primates. They're little monkeys. And there were two that were not from the same litter, and they had a lot of trouble bonding. So they were in two separate enclosures. The one, the female, had a doll, and everywhere she went, she took her doll. And that was her security blanket. Now, I was with her a lot all day, and she'd sleep in a little pocket on my chest at night. And one day I watched as a big cat that we have, and this is like a 15-pound cat, and this little 1-pound capuchin, the cat comes by, but all the other cats know, you know, like a dozen other cats and all these, nothing, just this one. And she's trying to get its attention. And the cat looks and just keeps walking. The next part of the afternoon, she runs back to her little food bowl, brings food over, and hands food out of the cage. She has a little piece of apple. So the cat comes over and sniffs the apple, but the cat doesn't want the apple. But the moment the cat came over, she dropped it down, and then when the cat went to sniff it, she started petting it. She started petting the cat. Now, over the next 2 months, every time the cat came by, she would bring something to it. And then the cat got to where it would come over and lay beside her enclosure, and she would just sit there and pet the cat. And she bonded with the cat. Now the cat comes over all the time. They bond. The cat goes in the enclosure. She gets down and hugs the cat, gives it kisses, grooms it, plays with its ear, and even rides it around, rides on its back. What do you call that?
Well, I think that's a remarkable case of, well, you could call it interspecific bonding, or you could just call it animal friendship. But, you know, but I think it's remarkable the way that sometimes animals can form links in the most unlikely way across species. I mean, if you think about it, the way that pets form bonds with us is another example of that kind of thing. I mean, in the wild, cats don't have people around stroking them and so on. And dogs in the wild are wolves. Dogs are domesticated wolves, and certainly they wouldn't have people around stroking them. They've formed bonds with us, and we've formed bonds with a whole range of species that in the wild, of course, would have nothing to do with people. Guinea pigs, rabbits, parakeets, parrots, horses. People even keep, you know, lambs as pets sometimes. I mean, things, animals that wouldn't normally be kept as pets can serve as pets. And I think that this ability to form bonds across species is, I mean, it's surprising in a way, but we do it all the time. The entire pet phenomenon is based on this. And in my study of pets and people's relations with them, I've come across many cases where there are unlikely friendships. For example, in one family, there's a budgerigar. I think you call them parakeets in the United States. They're small parakeets, which had formed a friendship with a cat. And normally, of course, cats tend to eat small birds. But this one would fly around the room and settle down by the cat and play with it. In fact, I visited this house to see this phenomenon. I filmed it. It was very remarkable to see a bird and a cat that had made friends with each other. So unlikely friendships can occur. We had a cat and a rabbit that formed an extraordinary friendship in our own household. They have to be thrown together in conditions where they feel safe and secure, and they don't have the chance to attack each other, which might be their first instinct, and build up these bonds. So I'm not sure what it proves, but I think it shows that the at least in social animals, the capacity to form bonds is very striking. It's part of their nature. And these bonds can be formed with members of other species, as we see all the time with dogs and cats and so on. And animals can also do this.
We saw this last year in Africa. Did you see that film of a lion that had adopted a baby wildebeest?
I didn't see that one. No.
Oh, it was absolutely unique. But, you know, instead of killing it, would it normally and eating it, it began to nurture it and protected it from others. Very interesting. Do you believe that that after this life, that our energy still exists?
You mean, do we survive the death of our
yes.
bodies? I do believe that, yes. I'm not sure that I'd call it the energy still existing, but I'd say some sort of consciousness does.
But what is consciousness without energy? How would it express itself?
Well, energy, I suppose, is the principle through which things are expressed, but energy may take various forms. My own way of thinking about life after death is that it's rather like dreaming. When we dream, every night all of us dream. We often forget our dreams, but we nevertheless dream every night. In our dreams, we're in a different world from our normal one. Our physical body is lying asleep in bed. Our dream body is going around doing things, sometimes even flying. You know, we can talk, walk, see people, and have this dream body. Now, I think when we die, it's a bit like going on having our dream body, but we can't any longer wake up because the physical body is not there. And so we're in a kind of dream state and a kind of dream body. Now, that dream body has a kind of energy, but it's not a physical energy in the normal sense of the word. But it's an energy that operates within that kind of virtual world, the world in which we dream. I mean, that's my own take on it. I mean, it may not be yours, but that's the best I can make in terms of trying to understand what might happen. Hmm.
I was in England, and I went to a healing circle over at 33 Belgravia Square, where the Psychic Society of Great Britain is, and it's been there for over 120
yes.
years. And there was a man named Maurice Barbanel, who was the editor of the Psychic News. And he was, as a young man, he was the person who was the first to be introduced to the presence known as the silver birch. Are you familiar with the silver birch?
I'm not, no.
All right. The silver birch, it was never known what kind of background he had, whether it was Native American or African. But he, whatever the source of the information, it was extremely brilliant. And I'd read all the books, and I asked him, I said, what was it like? And he said, well, he said, you go into trance, and suddenly you start writing and speaking in a tongue that you've never learned, but then they tape recorded it, and then it was from a particular language, and it was completely articulate. And then you start to write, and suddenly you're writing, you can't, it's just chicken scratch to you, but it's, someone decides this is a particular type of, how do you think that, and I said, how do you think all this manifests? And he said, well, I'm merely being used as a vehicle. Hmm. And he said, however, when the energies come, they're coming to try to share how people, in effect, can rebalance their energy in this world. And so I said to him, so you believe that then, that we are always in the presence of energies that are trying to communicate with us? And he said, yes. He says, just the difference is animals are more sensitive to it. Hmm. So they're more aware. And therefore, they're using that connection in a more intimate way than humans. We have layer upon layer of filtration system to deny it, to avoid it. Science has not recognized it, at least mainstream science has not. And what we can't see, what we can't feel and taste and hear, what is not present, we simply say doesn't exist. But he said there are many people who believe that it does, and that therefore they should always be aware that you are bearing witness even when you're alone. So think well of your actions and deeds and thoughts and be sensitive and open. So in one of the writings of the Silver Birch, it says that it's so important for us to stop being distracted and busy long enough to quiet our mind, because only through a quiet mind can we heal and can we connect with other people and can we share an energy. And the energy becomes a vibration or whatever you wish to call it. And the messages that are communicated no differently than if we had a radio receiver here and we're tuning it and suddenly across the dial and you get 60 different languages. You have to have a deciphering mechanism in order to see, I understand that language. And then I understand the message of that language.
Hmm.
How do you see this, if at all, in the work that you do in understanding, not only understanding the messages that we get, but understanding how to decipher them and apply them so that we can live a more peaceful coexistence of inclusion within our society?
Well, I like the radio receiver analogy or the television receiver analogy because although in some ways science as we know it gives the impression of being very hard-nosed, it's only what you can see, touch, hear, and so forth, that it counts. If you actually think about what's happened in modern science, it's gone the other way. Modern science now explains the visible in terms of the invisible. I mean, practically everything that modern science explains now is in terms of invisible fields or energies. The fact that you and I are sitting on our chairs rather than floating around the room is because of the invisible gravitational field that stretches out into space and holds everything together. The fact that radio works is because of invisible radio waves that pervade every room. This room we're in now is full of radio and TV transmissions and cell phone transmissions. There's X-rays from the sun and all sorts of particles from the solar wind shooting through our bodies and right through the Earth, neutrinos and other particles. None of these are visible. And the atom itself, the very basis of scientific exploration, is made up of largely empty space with vibratory patterns of energy within it. So this is the picture that modern science gives us is one of a largely invisible world of influences which manifests in material forms some of the time. And I think one of the most striking findings of modern science is that even the matter we know about, visible matter, if you look out at stars and galaxies and so on, even that is only about 5% of what is there in the universe. 95% is made up of dark matter and dark energy, and we haven't a clue what they are. So when people come on with this old-fashioned, hard-nosed science approach about, you know, it's got to be something you can touch or feel or stuff, that's 19th century science. 20th and 21st century science is very, very different, much more subtle, and much more acknowledging the invisible influences that work upon us. When we come to the invisible influences that work on our minds, I think there's many kinds of them. I think on the one hand, there's a kind of collective memory that influences us all. I have a theory called morphic resonance, the idea that there's a kind of memory in all nature. Every species has a collective memory. In fact, I think the so-called laws of nature are more like habits. I think the whole universe has a kind of memory within it. So I think that one pattern of influence is working on us all the time is a kind of collective memory, the habits of our species, and more particularly the habits of our ancestors and our family that we inherit invisibly. This has all sorts of influences on us. It enables us to learn things more easily if other people have done them before. I think it's one reason why young children can learn languages so easily. This is a puzzle for linguists. The famous linguist Noam Chomsky said that children must have an innate ability to learn languages because they learn them much quicker than you'd expect on the basis of stimulus-response psychology. And I think we do have this innate ability, but I don't think it's given by genes. I don't think it's hardwired in DNA. I think it's something we pick up by morphic resonance. We resonate with past speakers of the language. When you start learning to ride a bicycle or drive a car or learn how to do skiing or snowboarding or anything like that, I think you resonate with past people who've done it, and I think that they make it easier for you to learn. When you have a new skill, some newly invented sport, some newly invented skill like computer programming or something like that, or a new kind of video game, I think the more people that learn it, the easier it gets for others to do it. There's some evidence that this really does happen. There's a kind of collective memory in people and in animals. If you train rats to learn a new trick in New York, then rats all over the world learn to learn the same trick quicker. So one kind of influence working on us from the past, invisibly, excuse me, is through this collective memory given by morphic resonance. We don't see that. But I think it works on us all the time, and I think it works on animals all the time. And I think the instincts of animals are kind of the collective habits of the species which they inherit by morphic resonance.
Similar to the 100th monkey concept.
Yes, this idea is very similar to the 100th monkey concept. I don't use the 100th monkey story myself because it's not very well based scientifically.
Yeah, it's been discredited on some levels.
Yes. The story started with researchers in Japan thinking that potato washing behavior seemed to spread from island to island. The writer, Lau Watson, heard that, and he then exaggerated. He said, let us imagine that on a particular day, another monkey, say the 100th monkey, started doing it, then others instantly started to do it. He made it clear he was exaggerating it. Then it's got further exaggerated, and then the skeptics can easily wade in and say, oh, this isn't true. Actually, the germ of the story is true, I think. But there are much better documented examples, like the studies with rats that I refer to in my books, The Presence of the Past and A New Science of Life, where there's documented evidence that this sort of thing really happens. So that's one kind of influence that works on us invisibly. Another kind that works on us invisibly is from people we're close to, or from animals we're close to, and those are the influences that we could call telepathic or psychic, that these are the commonest kind of this. This sort of influence is one I've studied extensively in the last 2 or 3 years. It happens in connection with phone calls. You think of somebody, I might think of you, Gary, and want to call you up, and if I know you very well, we'd have this bond between us. And while I'm intending to call you and thinking about you, you might start thinking about me because you'd have picked up my intention. So when I ring you, you'd say, hi, Rupert, it's funny, I was just thinking about you. Now, this kind of telephone telepathy, people calling people who say, I was just thinking about you, turns out to be very common. About 80% of people in the United States have had it, including 80% of scientists in hard-nosed science institutes, because I've done surveys among regular scientists too. Most people dismiss it as a mere coincidence and say, oh, well, it's not really telepathy. You just think of people all the time. Sometimes one of them rings, and then you think it's telepathy as an illusion. It's an illusion because you forget the millions of times you're wrong. I've done actual experiments to test that idea and found that people are right much better, much more than chance, when they're rung up by a person in an experiment. In our experiments, we have 4 callers. We pick them at random. They ring the subject. The subject has to guess which of those 4 people it is. The subject can't know on the basis of habit or expecting someone to call at a particular time, because in this experiment, the callers are picked at random. So I think that example, telephone telepathy, is an example of one of the kinds of invisible influence that acts on us from other people.
So then it's a form of epigeneticism. We are affected by the people in the environment we're in, the energy we connect with them, or people from the past that we may never have seen or met, but somehow we are connected by some force field to them as well. That's what you're suggesting?
Yes.
All right, one last question before I know you want to give an experiment. You want the people in this audience to participate in that experiment. I want to give you time to explain that. But I'm sure you're familiar with the Japanese scientists who drop of water and froze it and then looked at it under a microscope, and it was just looked like broken shards of glass. Then he asked a group of Buddhist monks to meditate on like love or peace, and they did. And then when it was frozen, dropped and frozen, it was absolutely unique in its symmetry. There was no chaos concept to it, meaning that their intent actually created a physical reality. And it was done many different times, and many other people have done it since then. Is this something to what you're also alluding, that the intent to call someone, the intent to reach out to someone, in effect, allows a transmission? And if we do not accept that time and reality are necessarily synonymous, then it wouldn't matter how far a person was from us, nor would it then, by extension, to hold true the concept, mean whether the person was living or dead.
Well, let's take the intention bit first. I think that our intentions reach out from our minds. And in fact, the word intention comes from a Latin word meaning to stretch into. Our minds stretch out into the world around us. I think our minds are extended beyond our brains. And indeed, this doesn't fall off with distance. In some of our telephone experiments, we've had people in Britain with callers in Australia as far away as you can get, and it works just as well as with people in the next block. So with telephones, you can actually show this in detail. So yes, I think our minds reach out through intention and through attention. I discussed this in a book I wrote called The Sense of Being Stared At. That feeling that a lot of people have when they're being looked at by somebody else is because that person's attention reaches out beyond their brain to affect somebody that they're looking at. And so I think there's a lot of evidence our minds are interconnected in all sorts of ways, with each other, with the environment, with our ancestors, with people in the past. In all these ways, there are invisible influences working on us.
Fascinating. Time permitting, please give us your experiment.
Let me just mention it briefly then. I'm doing research on various forms of telepathy at the moment, and I now have some automated telepathy tests on my website, which I invite anyone to take part in. It's fun to do. You can find out how telepathic you are with your nearest and dearest. It's free of charge. The website's www.sheldrake, S-H-E-L-D-R-A-K-E, sheldrake.org, O-R-G. And there's a number of tests there. There's an email telepathy test. There's an online telepathy test. And there's also a test where you can find out whether you can tell when someone in your family or a close friend is looking at your photograph or not. And these are all fun to do. The evidence so far shows that these kinds of tests can work. Some people are more sensitive than others. And the best way to find out is to try.
Excellent. Give us your website again, please.
www.sheldrake, S-H-E-L-D-R-A-K-E .org, O-R-G.
I'd like for you to, we won't have time to really answer today, but at least think about it if you would, please. I believe that people, when they connect with an energy that is compatible with them, and they're both vibrating at the same level of intensity, that creates a bond that lasts forever. And I would like people to think about this. Think of the remarkable moments in your life. You think about it, you focus on it, and suddenly the very sensations you may have had at one time reappear. But then try to think of anything else that was not remarkable, and you can't think of anything. You know, what you ate 3 weeks ago on a Tuesday, you don't know. But it was, if it was 30 years ago and you had something happen with someone, that there was absolute rhythm of consciousness, I believe that that is a seal. In effect, you co-join someone, and that's forever. And I believe that once we understand how to balance our energies with other people, then whatever comes from that, whatever is experienced for that, is something there that we can use to remember, to feel, and feel good about ourselves. We're out of time. Thank you very much for coming in and sharing your thoughts with us.
A real pleasure.
My guest, Professor Rupert Sheldrake. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Noll.